probably one of the most common unintentional toxic exposures in the developed world today.
This diagnosis can sneak up on you.
This is really the realm of coma, seizure.
It matters, but it's only the first step.
This is really not that patient.
You need to have a high index of suspicion and test for this.
What's going on here? What are you thinking about?
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to our February 2019 podcast. We've got a great and very timely topic for you this month. We're going to talk about critical illness specifically related to carbon monoxide toxicity. A number of cases across the country, certainly as we have all been weathering record low temperatures and as people try to huddle around some warmth. We've certainly seen a slight uptick in CO toxicity, CO cases, so we thought it would be very timely, given that we're not out of the woods yet in winter here in North America. We thought it'd be best to talk about some important things treating patients with carbon monoxide toxicity. But before we jump into our podcast, let me bring in my three stellar EM critical care co-hosts, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Peter, let me start with you. How are things leading up to this podcast?
So things are going great. We were sad not to be in the Super Bowl for the New Orleans Saints. They thought they were tremendously robbed, which is unfortunate. But we were happy to see New England bring it home.
Yeah, that was quite some controversy. I didn't have a chance to follow it all, but I heard that there were some lawsuits filed, or potential lawsuits filed against the NFL for that. Is that true?
Well, they filed two different lawsuits, but most importantly, we usually lead the country in viewership for the Super Bowl, and only 24% of the televisions in New Orleans were tuned in to the Super Bowl, and they had second-line parades for it, a funeral dirge, the works. It was a fun time to be in the city.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rob, how are things out on the West Coast?
Things are great. Peter, you didn't miss much. It was the worst Super Bowl I've ever seen, by the way. Things are great here on the West Coast. It's a little chilly, but not chilly as I'm sure you're experiencing out there.
Yeah, exactly. For the first time that I can ever remember driving to work and actual temperature in my car thermostat or thermometer was -2. I wasn't sure that it would ever see negative numbers, but it does in fact go to negative numbers. John, how are you up north?
Doing well. I can't complain. Speaking of cold, I was watching the news and seeing how cold it was in Chicago. I really felt for the people in Chicago. It reminds me of my wife and I, we did an away rotation. We couples matched in residency in Chicago in August, and it was beautiful, wonderful city. It was green, lots of stuff to do outside. And then we went back to interview in January, and we got off the plane, and I believe the first words she said to me as we left the airport and got outside, as we were met with walls of snow, was, "Hell no." So I'm feeling for Chicago, and it's a great lead-in for this topic of carbon monoxide toxicity as we all have faced the polar vortex coming through the United States. And I came across this wonderful review article that was published just a few years ago in Critical Care, and the title was Carbon Monoxide Poisoning in the 21st Century, written by Angela Chu and Nicholas Buckley, which was a great review, and thought it would be very timely given kind of the temperature changes and all the different ways people are trying to stay warm as we're in the depth of the winter. So speaking about carbon monoxide toxicity, you know, I think it's probably one of the most common unintentional toxic exposures in the developed world today, particularly in the United States. We've done pretty well with arming our homes with carbon monoxide alarms, educating the public, and that has significantly reduced the annual death rate from 1,000 to 2,000 patients a year, which compared to across the seas in other countries is fairly low. But there are a number of annual exposures, about 50,000 a year, and most of them come from home heating systems, generators, and then we'll get the occasional intentional exposures from car exhaust, charcoal burning, heat devices, and catalytic converters. I think that what's interesting in this particular review is they noted that the incidence of carbon monoxide toxicity has particularly spiked dramatically in a number of Asian countries. They noted particularly Hong Kong as well as Taiwan after a really tragic and much publicized story of a 38-year-old woman who committed suicide in her bedroom by using a charcoal barbecue. And with that media attention, it spurred on a number of others to mirror this act and increase the number of exposures of carbon dioxide related deaths. At the end of the day, acute toxicity, aside from the most extreme toxicity leading to death, can lead to a number of clinically significant short and long-term sequelae that must be at least recognized and even considered in the emergency department. So why don't we go through this topic a little bit, and maybe we can just start off, Mike, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little about the mechanisms of how CO toxicity actually happens.
Thanks, John. That was a great introduction. And for the mechanisms of toxicity, I think these are things that we all just simply need to refresh ourselves of in terms of this condition, this disease, this toxicity. Recall that tissue hypoxemia in carbon monoxide toxicity is really simply due to the reduced oxygen carrying capacity of hemoglobin. So we know that carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin with a much higher affinity than that of oxygen. In fact, it's about 200 to 240 times the affinity for hemoglobin than oxygen. Now, in terms of that carboxyhemoglobin, remember that it prevents not only oxygen from binding to hemoglobin, but it also increases hemoglobin's affinity to hold on to any remaining O2 at the tissue site. So a significant increase in tissue hypoxemia. And in general, carbon monoxide, it has several mechanisms for cellular injury. So most prominent, it results in mitochondrial dysfunction, also leading to endothelial oxidative stress, some lipid peroxidation, and inflammation. And this is really this oxidative stress, the lipid peroxidation, is likely what's responsible for that delayed neurologic sequela, the long-term sequela that you just mentioned, John. In addition, it causes injury through impaired ATP synthesis and then also reperfusion injury once we begin to treat patients who have carbon monoxide toxicity. Remember, the two most common organs that are severely affected are those simply with the highest need for oxygen, and that would be the CNS along with cardiac in terms of the most common organs affected with CO toxicity.
Well, thanks, Mike, for that refresher. And I agree. I find myself having to go over this time and time again just to refresh yourself as to what's going on here. And that's a great lead-in. And I think the most common toxicities are a theme that's going to come up over and over again. So, Peter, as we're taking some of this information to the bedside, maybe walk us through your initial assessment and what you're thinking about as you're approaching that patient who maybe gets brought in by EMS with a concern for CO toxicity. What are you thinking about?
So there's a couple of things, but we'll start off with a basic understanding that the severity of poisoning is really a function of the carbon monoxide dose. And this is the duration of exposure and then the air concentration of carbon monoxide. Now, having said that, carboxyhemoglobin concentrations are only really a rough guide to the severity of the exposure. It's not a be-all and end-all, and we really need to use our clinical sense with this as well. We know that less than 20% of carboxyhemoglobin typically is associated with minimal symptoms, so these aren't really moribund patients. When it's 20 to 40% carboxyhemoglobin, we begin to see headache, tachycardia, confusion, some nausea, vomiting, and you may see some syncope associated with that. When we now bump it up to 40 to 60% carboxyhemoglobin, this is really the realm of coma, seizure. You'll see dynamic EKG changes, arrhythmias, and ST changes. And then once we're greater than 60% carboxyhemoglobin, cardiopulmonary failure and ultimately death. I think that what we really need to be keen on about this is that in a similar manner to Tylenol, your first measured carboxyhemoglobin is not really a reliable way to measure toxicity severity, or really it's not functional as a predictor of long-term outcome. And so there's a couple of patient modifiers that can really skew this for us and can affect specific patient populations. And it can also impact elimination half-life and just complicate things for us. So if we understand carboxyhemoglobin, it's going to be linked to our hemoglobin. So anemias or other hemoglobinopathies such as sickle cell disease or thalassemias can really complicate things. Likewise, if the patient has pre-existing coronary artery disease or pre-existing cerebrovascular diseases, remembering that those are the two organ systems, both brain and heart, that are going to be the most vulnerable. And then those patients can experience significant toxicity at what would be traditionally lower carboxyhemoglobin levels. And then there's some devices that are being developed to detect pulse ox, carbon monoxide oximetry. They've failed to pass a number of FDA regulations, and they really can't be recommended for triaging purposes or really clinical applications.
So those are some great points, Peter, particularly kind of tying that to Tylenol levels, that first level, it matters, but it's only the first step, because certainly our patients can have some confounding diseases or chronic illnesses that can make their exposure to whatever that carbon monoxide dose more significant for them. So that's a great pearl. So Rob, let's pass it to you. So Peter's just gone through a great initial assessment in terms of what he's thinking, but what are you doing in terms of laboratory testing or maybe some other diagnostic tests or questions that you're going to ask your patients?
Yes. So John, you're obviously going to want to start with a point of care venous carboxyhemoglobin level by blood gas. And there's some point of care devices that can do this, but if those are not available to you, you can send it to your lab right away. You're going to want to do an initial carboxyhemoglobin level and get serial levels as well. And in general, in terms of other lab testing, if the patient's severe enough or is being admitted, you're going to want to assess for organ ischemia and do some other standard lab testing, as well as check for those risk modifiers that Peter mentioned. So you're going to want to get a CBC, a BNP, some LFTs to look for liver dysfunction, a CK to see if there's any evidence of rhabdo, as well as other toxicity labs if this happens to be a suicidal type attempt. So you're probably going to want to also check your standard salicylate level and Tylenol levels and so forth. And remember also that in the setting of house fires or enclosed space fires, that cyanide toxicity can come into play. So you should also consider a cyanide level in those cases. I have to emphasize, however, that history and physical exam are really the gold standard in terms of determining the severity of carbon monoxide exposure as opposed to labs. So you really want to emphasize a diligent history and physical with special attention to neurologic and cardiac signs. So in severe cases, as Peter mentioned, you're going to get coma, seizures, metabolic acidosis, and signs of heart failure. But that's going to be the minority of cases. And in those cases, obviously, they're going to be admitted to an intensive care unit, and you're going to want to do a full complement of testing. In awake patients, the most significant signs or the things to most look for are syncope and chest pain. If either of those are present, then you really should start worrying about that patient and they may have significant exposure. So the best predictors of who's going to go on to develop long-term neurologic sequela and the best predictors of who may benefit from hyperbaric oxygen therapy are prolonged loss of consciousness, age greater than 36 years, and carboxyhemoglobin levels of greater than 25%. So those three are really the main predictors that you're going to be looking for in terms of who you might institute hyperbaric oxygen. In terms of other testing, it probably makes sense for anybody who's being admitted to get an EKG and perhaps troponins. And remember that you can also do a focused ultrasound to see if the patient is having signs of heart failure or reduced ejection fraction from their carbon monoxide exposure. And in one prospective study of transthoracic echo on 40 patients with carbon monoxide exposure, they found that 50% had significant LV dysfunction, from which they recovered in about 72 hours. So don't forget to use your ultrasound liberally in these patients.
Excellent points, Rob. I think there's a couple pearls in kind of what you just mentioned. I think most of us have access to a point of care VBG, and I know at ours, there's a carboxyhemoglobin number right on our VBG. So we're lucky that we don't have to send out any specific testing for that. But also those clinical things that place a patient at high risk, prolonged loss of consciousness, an age of only older than 36, which now in that category, well, been in that category, I suppose, and carboxyhemoglobin greater than 25%. Those are high-risk patients, and they may be a lot sicker at risk for prolonged illness from their exposure. Great points. So, Mike, we've kind of screened our patient, and we've identified that patient who's really going to be sick or that critically ill carbon monoxide poison patient. Tell us a little about your management strategy and how you're approaching the patient right off the bat.
Well, I think the main goal is to focus on providing some degree of supplemental oxygen and clearing that carbon monoxide. It is going to depend on that patient. If they've been brought to you from, say, a house fire, we're going to do what we traditionally do in terms of EM and resuscitation. We're going to focus and see if they need airway intervention, intubation, institutional mechanical ventilation, along with circulatory resuscitation. In terms of patients walking in or just simply being brought in, they're reasonably alert. They may not have significant cognitive deficits or in coma or perhaps seizing. I think all of us would be putting that patient on 100% non-rebreather. Now, just a few caveats there. If that patient, from whatever scenario, comes in and you decide to intubate them, we've talked a number of podcasts about the detrimental effects of hyperoxia in the critically ill patient, from the post-arrest patient to the neuro patient. And we've also talked about and emphasized, really, not leaving patients on 100% FiO2 and dialing down to not expose them to significant durations of hyperoxia. Well, this is really not that patient. In fact, you want to keep them on 100% FiO2 until you can get your serial carboxyhemoglobin levels to make ensure that the levels are decreasing. Now, in terms of the patient who has loss of consciousness, or they have significant cardiovascular comorbidities, or they're awake enough to report chest pain, or you get that EKG, as Rob indicated, and there are abnormalities or there are changes from prior ones, well, those patients are going to get serial ECGs, cardiac enzymes, to determine if there's any evidence of cardiovascular or cardiac damage. And then lastly, thinking about the patient who may have coexistent cyanide toxicity. Rob's mentioned it already, but especially in those house fire patients, looking for that elevated lactate and thinking and considering coexisting cyanide toxicity. Now, a common question is, what is the half-life of carbon monoxide when we use various treatment modalities? The patient in the room on breathing room air, and if you happen to practice at sea level, that half-life is going to be about 4 to 5 hours. Providing that same patient with 100% FiO2 via a non-rebreather decreases that half-life to about 40 to 80 minutes. And then if you institute hyperbaric oxygen therapy and dive them to 2 atmospheres, that half-life gets to around 20 to 25 minutes, somewhere around there. And delving into hyperbaric oxygen therapy, it's a little bit controversial, but I'm going to kick this over to Peter for a little bit more in-depth discussion on HBO therapy.
So let me tell you about the hyperbaric therapy, and I have to give a disclaimer because we have one of the largest fellowship programs for hyperbarics in the country. But the most beneficial effect may really be in the prevention of long-term neuropsychiatric sequela. That's the big evidence piece for this. Hyperbaric therapy does not appear to impact mortality, and I think you're going to see lots of arguments about that. There really isn't any standard hyperbaric therapy algorithms, and this is probably linked more to the continuum, or if you will, the spectrum of disease that carboxyhemoglobin presents at different levels. And if we're going to use it, should occur within 12 hours of the exposure. Most are patients who receive it between 45 minutes to 3 hours per dive, and the patient may receive a single session or they may have actual multiple sessions. So again, there's not one unique algorithm for all patients. So one of the things that we should think about is who really should be referred to a hyperbaric center. So if you look at ASAP and their recommendations, they say that HBO cannot be mandated. that there's no clinical variables, including carboxyhemoglobin levels, that can help find a subgroup of definitive benefit. The NIH says they do not recommend treatment, that there's insufficient evidence. Now, if you talk to my colleagues who are undersea and hyperbaric medical society card-carrying members, they say, who should dive? Patients with syncope, patients with abnormal neurological signs, patients with cardiovascular dysfunction, and patients with profound or severe acidosis. Again, they point to ages greater than 36 years of age with the first carboxyhemoglobin level of greater than 25%. They also, and this is a big reminder, pregnant patients, because we have to understand this, that fetus is at particular risk due to a higher affinity of fetal hemoglobin for carbon monoxide. So if it's pregnant patient, we really want to strongly consider diving those patients according to undersea and hyperbaric medical society.
Thanks, Peter. Those are some really great reminders. And I myself am also lucky to work at a hyperbaric center. And I think at our institution, we follow fairly similar criteria as what you described as a little bit of an older age, patients who are symptomatic or may have some physical exam abnormalities or lab abnormalities. And that first level above 25% is definitely a trigger for us. We do about 3 sessions that if they're not sick enough to be admitted to ICU, they'll go to our observation unit. But certainly if they're in our ICU, they'll continue to get multiple treatments while in the ICU and recovering. So Mike, Rob, any final points before we wrap it up and summarize kind of these final take-home points?
So I would remind our listeners that this diagnosis can sneak up on you. And it's not always going to be the case that you have an obvious presentation of carbon monoxide overdose or toxicity. You know, it's not always going to be the case that the patient's coming in from a fire or trapped in a car. Just remember that patients with altered level of consciousness, especially in this setting of colder days, and that you need to have a high index of suspicion and test for this. The second point I would make is that I work at a center that does not have hyperbarics, and I'd kind of put the question to you guys, is the improvement in those subset of patients, is it worth transferring a patient, some of these lower, less ill patients, to a hyperbaric center? There's a difference in half-life on the order of about an hour or so. And by the time you get the patient transferred, it seems like you would have a hard time justifying that.
I'd have a hard time advocating for someone who's less sick. I think if you have neuro findings, altered mental status, or cardiac findings, I would be pushing very hard. I'd also be pushing very hard for any pregnant patient.
Yeah, Peter, I would just echo your sentiment there. I think particularly because a lot of centers will do a series of sessions, not just a single session. So the thought is a lot of times with this mitochondrial dysfunction and other cellular injury that it can be prolonged, not just until the carboxyhemoglobin is still hanging around, that it can be after the fact. And there may be some benefit of pressurized oxygen therapy in those patients. So yeah, particularly patients who are critically ill, pregnant patients, or with significant physical exam findings. I think as well, I would say, yes, sure, send them on over if it's safe for the patient to travel.
At our shock trauma center in Baltimore, we do have a hyperbaric chamber, and we receive a lot of patients from the field, from our EMS colleagues, for hyperbaric therapy. Some transfers, but I think Peter and John have said it really eloquently that it's really for the more severe and potentially pregnant patients coming over on transfer. The majority of our patients we receive are directly from the field, directly from the house fire, potentially see suicidal gestures or intent. And many of them, you know, certainly if they're intubated, really sick, are going off to HBO therapy with our HBO colleagues.
Well, thanks, guys. And maybe I'll just take the last 30 seconds to summarize kind of the key take-home points that I got from you guys, as well as have to say thank you to Dr. Angela Chu and Nick Buckley on this wonderful review. So I think it's important just to remind our audience a few things. So severity of carbon monoxide toxicity should really be assessed by the patient's symptoms, not just by the level in which they are measured at the field. Remember, 100% non-rebreather for at least 4 to 6 hours for patients who are kind of walkie-talkie, but particularly as Mike pointed out that intubated patient, don't be in a rush to dial down that FiO2. Leave them on 100%. Hyperoxia is actually the goal. Most point of care VBGs will provide enough information to risk stratify your patient with carbon monoxide toxicity from a lab perspective. But again, history and physical will be the most important factor. And then, yes, the debate of hyperbaric oxygen therapy and whether or not it's standard of care is debatable, but certainly high-risk patients, those with loss of consciousness older than 36, are showing signs of organ dysfunction, and pregnancy not being a sign of organ dysfunction, but an actual something to consider, should probably be transferred if it's safe to get that patient to a hyperbaric oxygen chamber close by. So with that being said, I'll pass it back to Mike, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, John, for leading us through a wonderful discussion. I think it's exceedingly timely given the current temperatures and heating devices, certainly across North America. So very timely for those of you practicing clinically. Also very timely as a nice review for our residents that are about to take their in-training examination at the end of February, and probably also a nice review for all of us who are recertifying in emergency medicine. As you know, ABEM is offering a spring exam in March, in addition to the recert and initial qualifying exam next fall. So multiple important things that we've hit here on the podcast. Great, great discussion. We're going to bring things to a close. Remember that upcoming in June, we've got Resuscitation 2019 in Baltimore here. We've got a number of great speakers, lots of fun things to do here at Resus in June. And don't forget, Critical Points is no longer in December for 2019. In fact, it is September in sunny Scottsdale, Arizona. So very much looking forward to that. We will put website links in our handout for this episode for those two upcoming conferences. But we're going to bring this to a close. Once again, Mike Winters for Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. We will talk to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.